This is the LIO calling in for a sound check.
Hey, Doug, how's his first mic?
Good.
Second mic?
Good.
Third mic?
Third mic, good.
First testifier?
Testifier, good.
Second testifier?
Two, good.
Third testifier?
Good.
Seventh mic?
Seventh mic, good.
Eighth mic?
Eighth mic, good.
Ninth mic?
Ninth mic, good.
First chair mic?
First chair, good.
Second chair and last mic?
Second chair and last, good.
Okay, thank you.
Have a great meeting. Yep, bye.
Thanks.
That was a big... Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is two and a half minutes after 9 a.m. Makes us sound a little closer on time. April 18th, 2023. With me today here at the table is Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Bishop, Senator Merrick, Senator Keel, myself, Stedman, Senator Wilson's excused. On the agenda today, we're going to have the supplemental budget overviews on both operating and capital, and then we'll have some legislation at the end, Senate Bill 29, Civics Education, Senate Bill 87, Lumber Grading Program, Senate Bill 104, Civil Legal Services. So we thought what we'd do is start off with the supplemental budget overview. We may have questions. We thought it'd be a good reminder. There's a presentation. We can have representation from the administration come forward, I guess. Would you by chance just slide over to the middle? You'll be by yourself, I think. That makes it easier for the members on the sides to see the presenter.
Good morning, Chair Stedman and committee. Thank you for this opportunity to present to you on the supplemental budget. For the record, I am Paloma Harbor, a fiscal management analyst with the Office of Management and Budget. Neil is sorry he cannot be here with you this morning. He had a last-minute conflict. Since we went over the regular supplemental bill with the committee back on February 6th, this presentation is fairly high level in response to questions that were raised during that hearing. And then the attachments are focused primarily on supplemental amendments that have been submitted since that time. So we'll hopefully go through the presentation quickly, and then we can look at the attachments if the chair would like that. Okay. First, some high-level information. This slide shows the total number of the supplementals that the administration has submitted that have not yet been enacted. It does ignore the items that were in the fast-track supplemental bill that was passed earlier this session.
But what is the number? I mean, it's...
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
You got to make sure the folks at home could follow along.
Okay. So in total, both operating and capital, all amendments, unrestricted general fund, $113.3 million. Designated general funds, $50.6 million. Other state funds, $63.8 million. Federal funds, $125.8 million, for a total of, that total doesn't look right, huh? Around $353.5 million. Okay. Any questions?
No, we'll go on to the next slide.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Ms. Harbor, I guess one of the questions I have for you at the bottom of the slide, you've got the idea that the average price of oil is at over $87 a barrel.
Oh, yes.
How close are we to that number?
That's a great question. Through the chair, Senator Olson. As of April 10th, we're forecasting the actual amount to be 83.55, but the prices have been over that since that time. So we're somewhere in between.
Sure. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good. On that, do you happen to know what we're short in 23? If the average price is stays where it's, or if the price stays where it's at today versus this 87?
I don't, Chair Stedman, I don't have that number with me. I know it's a few hundred million.
That's fine.
Okay. Okay. So this just provides a summary by department of the operating supplementals. Big ticket items that have been discussed previously are the fire supplemental, Department of Corrections, public safety, university bargaining unit increases. Since the last presentation, the highest cost item that's been submitted is the judgment and settlements at $3.7 million, And that is provided, more detail on that is provided in the backup that we can discuss later. So capital supplement, This next slide shows the capital supplementals by department. In here, we have a grant system for commerce. We have the Lemon Creek Correctional Center supplemental, some airport improvement program match, and receipt authority for the university, as well as Exxon Valdez oil spill trustee council projects.
Okay. Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you explain the switch from federal funds to designated general funds for the university?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman. So this is mostly related to receipt authority. The university had a capital project for about $94 million in federal receipt authority. They did not receive one of the awards they were anticipating, so they've asked to decrement some of that hollow authority. And then they are asking for university receipts for other capital improvement projects so that they can raise funds to make improvements.
Do you have the specific project?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, there, it's in the backup details, and we can go through that.
All right, thank you.
Okay, so there were a number of questions that required follow-up responses at the February 6th hearing. Senator Wilson asked about the FY22 fire suppression and preparedness activity and why there appeared to be a lapse at the end of fiscal year 2022. The legislature appropriated $15 million in American Rescue Plan Act revenue that offset state costs for fire suppression activity in 22 and resulted in a small lapsed balance. Senator Bishop asked how much of the FY23 fire supplemental is remaining for fires. The January 31st supplemental bill was insufficient to cover fires, so we submitted amendments to that on February 14th that included $1.2 million to cover the summer and fall and an additional $6.8 million for spring fire activity.
Okay, and Senator Wilson's been online. I just want the record to reflect that. Next page, please.
Yep. Senator Hoffman asked about the Department of Corrections plan for managing situations where a correctional facility is over capacity. The Department of Corrections has recently taken proactive measures to ensure the correctional facilities do not remain overcrowded. Capacity levels are checked daily, and as numbers rise at intake facilities, the classification units, central transportation unit, all the units work together to develop a plan to move offenders to remain below capacity. Senator Hoffman also asked about the Department of Corrections plan for managing. Oh, looks like I have a copy and paste error. I apologize. Senator Stedman asked for information related to the increased utility costs within the Department of Fish and Game as it relates to the fuel needs for hatcheries. The department has provided a fairly detailed response on the cost increases from 20 to 22 for each of the facilities. I'm not going to read the whole thing unless the committee would like me to. Senator Keel asked about the methodology behind deciding which parks to reopen and whether or not there's a prioritized list. The Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation said they do not maintain a list or methodology to reopen parks because they are open to the public unless there's a reason to close. When situations arise that necessitate a temporary closure, the division works quickly to remedy and address those issues to reopen public access to outdoor recreation opportunities. Senator Olson asked for additional details regarding the Advanced Air Mobility Project. The Advanced Air Mobility Infrastructure Study will result in a report that will inform Alaska's build-out of next-gen technology to improve aviation safety and reliability. The study will include an inventory of all existing state, public, federal, and military infrastructure assets and a gap analysis that highlights needs for the full implementation of the plan.
And that concludes your presentation?
I have one more, Chair Stedman.
We have a question from Senator Bishop.
Yes, I'd like to go back to Senator Olson's question in your second response. Mr. Chairman, if I could ask, who's online from DOT?
Dom Pannone should be online.
Oh, I'll take it offline with the Deputy Commissioner on Aviation on that one. Thank you.
Okay.
Last page, please.
Okay. Senator Hoffman requested confirmation regarding whether or not there are shortages for ice roads that need to be addressed. The department is not aware of any additional needs or identified shortages for ice roads, and they've provided a summary of the different ice road funding opportunities in the budget.
Okay.
And that concludes the presentation, and if you would like to go over the attachments.
Yes, that'd be nice. We'll do attachment one first.
Okay, attachment one and attachment two go together. Attachment one is an operating supplemental summary spreatsheet, and then attachment two are backup pages with more details on each of the requests. And the first item on the summary is on page four of the backup file. So I apologize, the first three pages are not on the spreadsheet. So, do you want me to go line by line?
What was that? You're losing me here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We have attachment number one.
Yes, attachment number one.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to walk through that
Okay. Relatively
quickly, I think.
Yes. So On March 22nd, we submitted a supplemental amendment for judgments, settlements, and claims for $3.7 million.
I think that what we'll do, if it's all right with the members, because there's quite a few pages here, we'll have you hit the highlights. On some pages may have no highlights, and then we'll just pause for a minute on each page in case an individual member has a question. Some of these items are very small. So the first item to take note of is item number one on page 1 of 25. And is there any other standouts on page one? Okay, we'll go to page two. Do you have any comments on page two?
Yes, Chair Stedman, on the fire supplemental, as I mentioned, in the amendments released on February 14th, we included about $1.2 million to finalize the payments for expenses that had already been incurred, and then about another $6.8 million for future fires in the spring.
So we probably want to reference the number so the members can keep track.
Oh, I'm sorry. Lines nine is to close out the fire costs already incurred, and then line eight is for spring fires.
Any other questions on this one? Okay, next page. Any major highlights there?
So a lot of the Department of Administration supplementals are all related to one issue. They were unable to pay their FY22 lease payment. They do have to pay the public building fund for that cost. They can't afford to pay 2 years worth in FY23, so they do need a supplemental. And then there was an unanticipated cost in the Division of Finance related to some moves that were occurring.
Okay, on page four, looks like another series of lapses.
Yes, that's correct.
Anything on page five?
Chair Stedman, the only thing really on here is that some cleanup items for bargaining unit increases that were missing in AEA's budget.
Okay.
Oh, and their last item, line 34, is for the Department of Corrections to partner with the Department of Public Safety on investigations of crimes committed by inmates.
Crimes committed by what?
Inmates.
Okay. Next page.
Chair Stedman, this overall, these amendments for Department of Corrections represent the significant operational shortfall that the department is experiencing related to short staffing, capacity issues, moving in inmates between facilities, all of those expenses.
Right. Overtime and other things.
Yes.
Okay. Next page, page 7.
Page 7 is just a continuation of the Department of Corrections costs. I will say that line 41, the one area Department of Corrections has seen success is their physical health care costs are down. And so they are using that to help offset the cost overruns elsewhere.
Okay, next page.
So on this page, we have primarily the Department of Education and Early Development. They are experiencing higher than normal administrative hearing expenses and require a supplemental. And then there's the WAMI contractual increase. It looks like there is line 48 is for fish and game. And I believe the next page has several supplementals for fish and game as well. These are operating costs, utility cost increases they're experiencing that they cannot accommodate within their existing budget.
The hatcheries in Fairbanks?
Yes, that's correct.
I'd just like to make a comment.
Senator Bishop.
On this line 48, it's interesting to note that electricity rates have increased 50%. Cheap energy, that's our key to our future, Mr. Chairman.
And you're referring to Fairbanks, I suppose, not Anchorage. Okay. We'll get another 50% increase and we'll be back to prosperity under those terms. So we'll go on to page 9, please.
Chair Stedman, page 9 just includes additional costs at Fish and Game in the various regions related to utilities and other operational cost increases.
Okay. And if any member has a question on any of these, flag, even if we speed by the page and we have to back up. Page 10.
Page 10, the item, the note is the Alaska Vocational Technical Center. They have not been able to generate the general fund program receipt revenue that they need to balance their budget. And so they need $570,000 in unrestricted general funds.
Okay, that's item 55?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Next page.
Page 11. Item number 60 is the $50 million fire supplemental that was originally submitted. And then item number 62 is an $8 million supplemental ask for the Department of Public Safety.
Okay. Next item. Our next page.
Page 12 includes $186,800 for the tax system to move to their cloud server hosting option from the vendor that provides them that system.
Okay, next page.
Page 13 is mostly small items. Transportation does have item number 76, $180,000 for Homer natural gas and water sewer assessments.
Okay, next page.
On page 14,
for those watching, keep track of where we're at.
Yes, page 14 of the spreadsheet, line 77 is $290,000 for Newtok and Murtarvik airports. They're trying to maintain both the airports until the transition can be made completely for the communities, and they require additional funding.
Okay, next page.
Page number 15, the only item here with unrestricted general funds is line 80. And it's just operational costs for rural airport contracts.
Okay, next page.
Page 16, it looks like there's some, these are all international airport cost increases that they're experiencing relating to service contracts, utilities, de-icing replacements.
And these are other funds, not general.
That is correct. They're all international airport funds.
Page 17.
Page 17 is a continuation of those international airport costs.
Okay. And 18?
Page 18 is more international airport costs.
Page 19.
Page 19 is additional international airport costs at Fairbanks.
Okay. Question from Senator Bishop.
What line, what's your number on Fairbanks international airport costs, Palmer?
In total?
Are we on page 18?
We are on page 19.
What line?
Line 101 through 105 are all Fairbanks International Airport. And then, I think that's it.
I have a question for Don Pannone.
Mr. Pannone of DOT, there's a question. Senator Bishop, question, please.
Mr. Pannone, so we've got a little bit of an issue on wages in Fairbanks for the operators. Has that been taken care of for the maintenance operators at the airport? I've had several emails to my office, and I've even got a call from Alaska Airlines. And we're wondering, is Fairbanks, do we have an LOA now that makes these guys whole on this on their wages consumer with Anchorage?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the department did submit a supplemental request for funding for that mission critical incentive pay, I believe, back in January. I know we are actively pursuing the language with labor relations and the union. We can provide an update to your office if you'd like, through the chair.
That would be follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Yes, that would be fine, because I want to make sure we still got a workforce, and we need to expedite that. Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pannone, I want to thank you for coming out today. I've also got a phone call, but this was from Northern Air Cargo. We're dealing with a Nome airport where apparently they had some damage to one of the jet engines that was there and was checking to see what the mission critical status of it, if you can get back with Senator Bishop and myself on that. And I guess I'm not completely understanding that there is an individual component to that as well, where the individual people that are now on the payroll can go ahead and apply for that mission critical status.
Through the chair, Senator, when we implement a mission critical incentive pay, it is provided to our existing staff as well as new staff. It's a retention and recruitment tool to keep our airports and infrastructure running. Absolutely.
Last question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
How effective is this mission critical status, or do we need to increase the amount that's there needed?
Through the chair, the department's found a lot of success when we implement this by location. Generally speaking, we found that a 30% increase over existing salaries has been effective when we utilize it, when recruitment and intention is the issue at a particular location. So 30% is what we've been using as a general basis.
Mr. Pannone or Mr. Harbor, do you have a response? I see you twitching at the end of the table. waiting for Mr. Pannone to hang himself.
But. No. You did a good job responding, Chair.
Okay.
But we do know that salaries across the board need to review, and that is part of our capital budget proposal.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Actually, we do kind of keep an eye on that, so the representative from the different departments don't inadvertently overstep. And so we'll try to keep an eye on that. Page number 20.
All right, on page 20, all items 106 through 110 are related to University of Alaska bargaining unit cost increases.
Okay. Next page.
Page 21, line items 111 through 115 are also related to University of Alaska bargaining unit increases.
Okay. Next page.
Page 22, line items 116 through 120 are all related to bargaining unit increases at the university.
Next page.
Page 23, line items 121 through 123 are again related to the university bargaining unit increases. For the legislature, line items 124 through 133 are primarily related to health insurance rate increases. There are two items in here that are not. It looks like line 128 is for program receipt authority for the assembly building. And line item 133 is related to the attorney salary increase that was provided.
Okay. Next page.
Page 24. Line items 134 through 139 are all related to health insurance increases in the legislature.
Okay.
And then starting on line 142, we're looking at language items in the supplemental budget. Of note on this page is probably just line item 147, a $2.8 million fund deposit, fund capitalization for the Clean Air Protection Fund.
Okay, and I think that's not in our budget. We're working on that numeric, trying to refine that with the department.
Okay.
Item page 25.
Page 25, line item 148 is again a fund capitalization, but this time for the Workers' Compensation Benefit Guarantee Fund in the amount of $221,400.
Okay. And for the public, you want to briefly go over the totals here that went through in 25 pages? Line 152?
Line 151.
Excuse me, 51.
Nope, that's fine. So the total for operating supplementals is 102.4, or almost 5 million unrestricted general funds. Designated general funds, 20.6 million. Other funds, 15.2 million. And federal funds, 115.2 million, for a total of 253.5 million.
Does any member have any questions on these pages? If you do, just, you know, we can get back and get further detail. We do have a stack of backup papers and binders.
Okay, then on to attachment number three.
Attachment number three, capital supplemental.
Yes. So again, attachment number three is a summary of the capital supplemental items, and then attachment number four are the project details, and they are referenced by line. So line number two. Is a reappropriation for elections. Line item number three is a reappropriation to the Department of Transportation for emergency weather, catastrophic events, and unforeseen critical maintenance needs of $9 million.
And that was on March 22nd.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Chair Stedman, thank you.
Yeah, now on February 14th, capital supplementals. Would you please highlight the four?
Yes. On February 14th, we submitted four capital supplementals. The first, line six, was a scope change for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. They had received a prior year appropriation for a veterans cemetery. The scope just needed to be altered so they could use it in the new site that's been identified. Line item seven is statewide contingency authority for airport improvement program federal receipts. We're seeing a lot of competitive grant opportunities open up for airport improvement projects. And then line item number eight is another reappropriation for emergency weather and catastrophic events of almost 7 million at Department of Transportation. And then line item nine is the University of Alaska's authority cleanup that was referenced earlier, Senator Hoffman.
Okay. And then supplemental bill capital number section.
Starting on line 12, this is what was submitted in the original bill. First, line 12 is $150,000 in federal surplus revenue, program revenue, to cover storage needs for the surplus program. Line item 13 is federal receipt authority for Alaska Energy Authority for infrastructure money. And then line item 14, again, federal receipt authority for infrastructure funds. for AEA. Line item 15 is the grant system replacement for commerce. Line item 16 through 24 are all related to the Exxon Valdez oil spill trustee council projects. There were revised programs legislative that were passed for these, but we need them in the capital budget. And then line item 25 is Federal Emergency Management Agency Community LIDAR Collection Federal Receipt Authority for Department of Natural Resources of $5 million. Line item 26 through line item 31 are all Airport Improvement Program Receipt Authority for federal grants that have been awarded for these projects. And then line item 31 is additional state match for federal airport improvement program. Okay. Line item 32 is University of Alaska Anchorage Health Workforce Expansion. Phase one, they're asking for federal receipt authority for this. Line item 33 is that generic university receipt authority for capital projects of $30 million. And then line item 34 is generic federal receipt authority for capital projects of $30 million. Okay. And then starting on line 36, the supplemental bill also had some language appropriations. Line 37 is a reappropriation for the retirement system project from the governor's office to the Department of Administration. Line 38 is Lemon Creek Correctional Center repairs that are needed of $9.5 million. Line 39 is a reappropriation for the Norm Youth Facility project. And line 40 is a reappropriation for Alaska Pioneer Homes. So page 2 of 2 of the capital project summary, line 41 is a reappropriation for substance use disorder service expansion to the new Department of Health. Line 42 is a reappropriation of the health IT management solution from the Office of Governor to the Department of Health. And line 43 is a repeal of a permanent fund dividend division prior year capital project.
Do you have any questions on any of the capital supplementals? Okay. Anything else?
That's all.
Okay. Seeing we have no other questions, we'll take a. That'll conclude this portion of the meeting. We'll have a brief at ease while we set up to take care of some legislation. It'll just be 2 or 3 minutes. We are at ease.
Good morning. Let's call the Senate Finance meeting back to order. We are hearing a number of bills this morning. These have already been heard. Senate Bill 29, Senate Bill 87, and Senate Bill 107, and we'll see if we can move them on out. First up is Senate Bill 29, Civics Education by Senator Stevens. We first heard it on March 14th, took public testimony. The committee substitute has been distributed to the member. Senator Bishop, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate CS for Senate Bill 2933-LS0246 /R from committee with individual recommendations, attached fiscal note, and authorization for alleged legal to make any conforming changes.
I'll object. Question brief, at ease.
At ease.
I'll remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. I'll object for purposes of discussion. We'll call up the bill sponsor, Tim Lampkin. Come on up and explain the bill. And Ken Alper, go ahead and we'll also come on up to explain the changes with the CS. Mr. Lampkin, just kind of give us a capsule so we remember what we're dealing with and how we're doing things and what the plans and changes are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. Thank you for hearing this bill once again. Before you is a bill that would put some emphasis on civics education in our state education system. It includes a requirement to either take a semester course in a civics curriculum program or pass a test that's based on the U.S. Immigration Services for citizenship. That's an overall quick summary of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. If you'll stay there afterwards and make a comment on what the CS is going to do. After Mr. Alper presents what the CS or what's included in the committee substitute. Mr. Alper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ken Alper, staff to Senator Olson on the Finance Committee. As Mr. Lampkin said, the bill requires the Department of Education to create a civics education curriculum, and that would be offered to students in high school, and then there would be an exam modeled on the U.S. citizenship exam. In the earlier version of the bill that came to you from the Education Committee, there was also a commission, the Alaska Civics Education Commission, a 12-member body chaired by the Lieutenant Governor with various boards and commissions, responsibilities, appointments, meeting schedules. That commission has been removed.
Call the Finance Committee back to order. Senator Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, I move my first motion, rescind my action. And I move Senate CS for Senate Bill 2933-LS0246 /R as our working document.
And I'll object for explanation of the changes. Mr. Alper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Continuing for the record, Ken Alper, staff to yourself. What I was earlier saying was that the bill that came to you from the Education Committee had this new commission chaired by the Lieutenant Governor. That commission has been removed from the committee substitute, and with it a couple of sections of conforming language. It is the hope and expectation that that will reduce the fiscal note a little bit because of the costs associated with running one more commission. The guts of the bill remain that creates the curriculum and makes the education available and required for high school students. The only other change, Mr. Chairman, is moving the fiscal note forward 1 year, the effective date forward 1 year, so this bill would take effect on July 1st, 2024. As it came to you from the prior committee, it said July 1st, 2023. And those are the changes in the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Alper. Mr. Lampkin, could you give us some comments on the changes?
Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. Senator Stevens is supportive of these changes. I think it would help make this a better bill. And sort of in wrap up here, notwithstanding today's procedural hiccup there, I'd like to report that Senator Bishop received 100% on his civics exam.
Right on!
They almost got out of gavel out of that easy and congratulated.
Didn't get the extra credit question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lampkin, and congratulations, Senator Bishop.
Thank you.
So with that, I remove my objection. The working document is in front of us. Any amendments for the piece of legislation? Any additional comments by the committee members? If not, Senator Bishop, is there a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 2933-LS0246/R from committee with individual recommendations, attached fiscal notes, and authorization for Leg's legal to make any conforming changes.
There's no objection. We'll go ahead and take an at ease so we can send it to paper. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. The next bill up is Senate Bill 87 by Senator Bjorkman, lumber grading. We first heard this on April 12th. We took public testimony. Are there any amendments for this piece of legislation? If not, we'd ask the Senator Bjorkman and his aide, Laura Ashe, to come on up and comment on it, give us some final comments, and then we'll see what happens after. Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Finance Committee, for hearing this bill, Senate Bill 87, local lumber grading, again today. To recap, for purposes of the record, thank you very much. I am Senator Jesse Bjorkman from Senate District D. To recap this bill creates a local lumber grading program, which would allow dimensional lumber produced locally in the state of Alaska to be graded by the local lumber millers and then certified to its quality by those millers and sold as lumber to be used in residential construction of units up to 3 residential units. Currently, if there is to be financing done on a residential structure like that, the lumber used in the structure has to receive a grade stamp from an industry group like Western Wood Products Association or similar. However, the costs to join such an industry group are high, and as such, they are a barrier for most local lumber millers to be a part of them. This program would lower that barrier and ease access for lumber and building materials for folks that would like to build homes in Alaska. This program would be especially beneficial to folks in rural Alaska in reducing the cost of building and construction materials and facilitate easier home construction in many parts of the state. I'd like to see this program really be a catalyst for investment in forest management, as well as to help encourage and build our timber sector statewide. It is my goal that this program will result in permanent, stable, family wage jobs in rural communities and villages to strengthen and diversify our local economies all over the state of Alaska. A larger timber sector, in turn, can provide additionality needed for creating carbon offsets if we are to go in that direction in the future. But the bottom line for me, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Senate Finance Committee, is this program can be an economic driver to put more lumber on the market for people to build homes at a lower cost. Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Senate Finance Committee. I'm happy to receive any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. Senator Stedman.
I just have a quick question. So if an individual goes and gets the training and gets the certification to go ahead and grade lumber, then that individual could go down the street and grade the other smaller lumber mills in the regional area or on the island also. Is that correct?
Senator Bjorkman.
Through the chair, thank you very much for that question, Senator Stedman. No, that's not how this process would work. A local lumber miller would receive training to grade their own lumber and certify to the quality of lumber that they would create, knowing the process that they use and knowing the raw material trees and logs that they use to create that lumber. They certify to the quality of that lumber based on the training that they receive, and then they sell it to the end user themselves.
Senator Bjorkman, I guess I don't understand why a person that can do his own lumber can't go down the street, as Senator Stedman talked about, and grade somebody else's lumber. He's essentially doing the same thing, just at a different site that he may not own. Why is that not included?
So ultimately, the reasons why that is not included is we have used a program and based our program in this legislation under programs that exist in similar states. And I tend to agree with their goals that people are verifying the quality of their own work because they know the processes that they use to create the products that they are producing. They know the trees, they know the logs that they're using, and they also can verify as to the quality of their own work as an individual in a local community that certainly has a reputation to uphold. So as those lumber sales happen across the flatbed trailer or the bed of a truck and someone looks their neighbor in the eye and sells them a load of wood, it's important that they know that wood is good.
Okay. Ms. O'Shea, we'll have some final comments after we get a question from Senator McKeel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Continuing on the safety line of questioning, I had posed, a question at the last hearing and got some written responses. I wonder if you could just go over briefly. There's nothing in the bill that talks about height of structures and the risk that comes with that, but I understand there are other statutes that sort of address that. Can you talk about those briefly?
Senator Bjorkman.
Very good. Thank you for that question through the chair, Senator Keel. I will ask my staff, Laura Ashe, to answer that question.
Thank you. Senator Keel, through the chair, this is Laura Ashe, staff to Senator Bjorkman. It's correct. The bill itself and the statutes it would create do not set a height limit on a structure. But there are other requirements in state law that say that structures over a certain height would require the stamp of an engineer or architect on the design. And an engineer or architect, due to the seismic concerns in Alaska, would be very reluctant to sign off on local lumber used in structures that exceed that point because that lumber hasn't had seismic resiliency testing. The lumber that you buy from a box store or a retailer has not only been graded by a lumber grading agency, but it has been had selective pulls that are sent to laboratories where they are tested for seismic resiliency. So it's not an outright prohibition, but when there were architects in the building on other matters, we spoke with them and they assured us that that simply wouldn't happen, that you would see local lumber used above, I believe it's two stories for a fourplex or three stories for a duplex.
Thank you.
Follow-up, Senator
Keelan. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's a helpful hedge that keeps us in a safe zone.
Do you have any closing comments on this bill before we move it out, Ms. Asha?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just think it's very important to recognize the hard work of Jeremy Douse, the Northern Region Forester at the Department of Natural Resources, Dr. Priscilla Morris at the United States Forest Service. They have worked very hard to meet with stakeholders and hear their concerns and to work with other states that have similar programs to put this program together. They've been here to testify before the committee and answered all our questions. And so they definitely deserve a huge amount of recognition for this.
Well, thank you very much for that. Having just...
Mr. Chair?
Is that Mr. Douse? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair?
Take an address. Come back online. Senator Wilson, I didn't recognize your voice. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Following Senator Keel's question on sort of the structural integrity of lumber over a certain height of structure, would local grade lumber be insurable by insurance companies for just earthquake use or other usage?
Senator Bjorkman.
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, yes, that is the nature of this bill in its essence is that this local use lumber is strong. It does have the strengths and characteristics that you would find in other lumber that comes from very similar trees. And so the difference is that it doesn't undergo mechanical testing. However, the trees are still the same trees. As mentioned in an earlier hearing, we have very excellent forest resources here in Alaska because of the slow growing and tight ring nature of our spruce trees. And that makes for some very strong lumber and very strong wood here in Alaska. So I have no doubt that the trees that are used to produce this lumber that could also be used to build masts and ships and other very, very strong applications are going to withstand the pressures that one would expect lumber to hold up under in earthquake scenarios and other wind and force events.
Follow up, Senator Wilson.
Mr. I guess my question is, would a home seller or buyer have to disclose that they've used local source wood?
Senator Bjorkman.
So as we've talked to the industry through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and other stakeholders in that space through the chair to Senator Wilson, no, it would be no different than building their home under the building code with lumber that has been grade stamped through a normal process. This lumber has been certified as to its quality by the person that produced it, that has received the training in order to do that, just like we rely on folks that receive training to certify that their services are good in a number of different respects around the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to speak in support of this bill, and let me go back and look at a little bit of history. We had, 130 years ago, 140 years ago, they started building large canneries all through the coastal Alaska, from south of Ketchikan all the way up around the chain and up into Bristol Bay. That, a lot of that material was locally harvested and cut, including housing. These structures were fairly large, the big gear sheds of these canneries. And we had multiple houses built. Well, not multiple. We had pretty much all our houses built back in the early 1900s. That was all locally cut lumber. There's nothing wrong with our lumber. It's just we just need to get the ability to cut it and use it. And having a height restriction of a on a single family dwelling or a threeplex doesn't seem to be any big deal. And I think we should advance this piece of legislation, Mr. Chairman, and then look to the next phase of this, because I think it would be nice if somebody was certified to grade lumber, could go and grade and stamp the number of his the lumber of his neighbors, or you know, within a easy access. I'm thinking of the islands, particularly like Prince of Wales, where we have several people with sawmills, and I don't see why they can't have one grader or a couple of graders. And you can have your colleague down the road come and grade your lumber. I mean, if you're cutting crappy wood, it's going to be pretty obvious. Those guys won't even need a class to tell you that it's crappy wood. So I think it's a very good start, and I hope we get this across the floor of the Senate and signed by the governor.
Thank you very much, Senator Stebbins. Senator Bishop.
I'd just like to echo Senator Stebbins' comments and put just a couple more points on the history lesson. You go look at some of these homes in Juneau and Douglas, and there's one right across the street, and you go look at the floor joists. They're 2 by 6, not 1.5 by 5 7/8, and they're still standing.
Thank you very much, Senator Bishop. With that, I want to congratulate you on getting this bill across. Senator Bjorkman, I think that if you talked about the trees that are stronger up here because of the tighter growth rings, that's certainly a point that's there with the longer winters. And we look at the history, and we talked about, you know, Sitka spruce, which we used to use for aircraft spars that we, a long time ago. And myself personally, having just built a major building 65 feet by 100 feet long and 25 feet high, we used a lot of lumber, and I want to thank you for coming forward with something like this that made it affordable. With that, we have a motion, Senator Merrick.
Thank you, yes, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill 8733-LS0380/S from Committee with Individual Recommendations, attached fiscal note, and authorize Legislative Legal Services to make conforming changes.
Without objection, Senate Bill 87 moves from committee. call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. Our next bill up under bills previously heard is Senate Bill 104 by Senator Dunbar, Civil Legal Services Fund. We first heard it on April 12th. We took public testimony. We asked for amendments. None were given. So Senator Dunbar and your aide, Ari Wiggins, please come on up and identify yourself for the record and go ahead and give us bird's eye view of what we're looking at here before we pass it out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Senator Forrest Dunbar with my aide, Ari Wiggins. SB 104 amends the statute creating Civil Legal Services Fund AS 37.05.590, so that up to 25% of court system filing fees can be appropriated by the legislature to the existing Civil Legal Services Fund each year to provide access to civil legal aid for low-income Alaskans with critical legal needs. And, that's technically what it does, but I'd just like to reiterate sort of on a practical level what this does. Alaska Legal Services Corporation provides free legal aid to people around the state. They have a significant rural Alaskan presence. They are the state's largest provider of civil legal services to survivors of domestic violence. They also provide critical family law, landlord-tenant law services, access to benefits. Through that access to benefits, they bring in additional federal funds to our state. And in general, they protect some of the most vulnerable members of our society. This fund was initially set up where 10% went to legal services. They have seen a dramatic increase in the number of cases, and that funding is no longer sufficient. Online, we also have Nicole Nelson, the executive director of the program, and she's willing to answer any questions you might have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have any members of the committee that want to go ahead and ask the bill sponsor for questions on this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, this is Senator Wilson.
Senator Wilson, please.
Yes, not a question, just a comment. I just want to make sure that this is Alaska Legal Fund is not the grantee in this nature. This is a grant that is administered for these legal services, and that it's up to 25%, and that does not take away the appropriation of the legislature. Just want to put those clarifiers out there. Thank you.
Senator Dunbar?
No, I appreciate Senator Wilson's comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further questions by members of the committee on this bill, Senate Bill 104? Now, I'm sorry, Senator Bishop.
I just want to thank the bill sponsor for bringing the bill forward, and I just hope we could do more in the future to meet the needs of those that aren't getting served in this arena.
Especially since the increase in numbers have been so high lately, or recently. Any final comments, Ms. Wiggins? You're carrying the bill.
No, for the record, R.L. Wiggins, staff to Senator Dunbar. No, I appreciate the committee's consideration. Thank you.
Okay. There has been a concern about the fiscal note, so let Ken Alpert come on up and describe the concern and then clear up the concern. Mr. Alpert.
Hello again, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ken Alper, staff to yourself. The original fiscal note that came with the bill has been updated by the Department of Commerce, Community, and Regional Affairs. This is component number 2879. We had identified a couple of technical issues with it. Like Senator Dunbar said, the bill increases the share of these court filing fees going to the program, roughly $450,000 per year. What that really does is take what's currently general fund money, that 15% increment between the 10 and the 25, and turns it into a designated general fund item. The fiscal note didn't capture that really we have to subtract the amount of general funds that we have to offset the increased amount of designated funds. There's no new money coming here. It's simply shifting existing money. And the fiscal note didn't really fully capture that this is a multi-year thing, that it, not just in FY24, but in subsequent years, the same approximately $450,000 additional DGF and reduced UGF. So this just corrects it technically, and the bill itself is unchanged.
Thank you very much for clearing that up, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Alpers. And I believe the court testified on the record this would have no impact to the court system.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the court itself is funded by UGF. They don't get to keep that money anyway. So what comes in through the filing fees goes to the collective for general appropriation.
Thank you.
When you're ready, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dunbar, you have any comments on the fiscal note that in the clearing up of the concerns that are there?
No, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Alpert did a good job explaining the situation.
Any final comments by members of the committee or questions by members of the committee on this bill? Not Senator Merrick. I'm sorry. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm champing at the bit. I move the Senate Finance Committee report out Senate Bill 104 from committee. That's 33 LS 0605/A as in Anchorage with individual recommendations and the new fiscal note.
Without objection, this bill is moved out of committee. The next committee referral.
Thank you.
We're under bills previously heard. We're going to be hearing Senate Bill 107, which has to do with the POMV. I want to thank members for being for being tolerant of what's going on here in the last hour. With that, we'll have Mr. Ken Alpers come on up and give us the presentation that he has related to the bill, where it started, where we're at, and what's come up so far. And then after that, we'll go ahead and have the presentation by Pete Eklund related to the CS that's been adopted. Mr. Alper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ken Alper, staff to Senator Olson on the Finance Committee. The co-chair has asked me a couple, 3 weeks ago to put together a sort of historic piece, how we got here, what we've used for savings in the past, to put some context on why Senate Bill 107 is important as a pinning down of the POMV split and moving forward towards a comprehensive fiscal plan. This was originally before the committee and got delayed because of some other action. So given we have some time at the end of the day today, I was asked to bring it up on the fly. I'm happy to do so for the committee. Mr. Chairman, the Permanent Fund has been with us since the 70s, and it's been mostly, let's call it, growing in the background. More money's been deposited, the money's been reinvested, and it's grown from zero to currently about $76 billion. And as you know, half of the statutory earnings up through 2016-17 were distributed as dividends. And Senator Stedman has made this point multiple times, and I'm glad that he has. The other half of the earnings that could have been spent by the state were not spent, and they were left in the fund. So the value of the Permanent Fund now includes essentially the compound interest on money the state could by law have taken year by year over the last 40 years. And so the top chart there on the upper right is the value of the fund itself. The lower right is the statutory dividend for the years that the statutory dividend was used, and just showing the wide variation from year to year tied to current earnings at the time. This idea that the state could have pulled the other half of the earnings and used it for different things, well, what would they have used it for? Could have been more spending, it could have been larger dividends, we could have used it to offset other state revenues, lower oil taxes, or we could have simply invested it in something other than the Permanent Fund that wouldn't be subject to the dividend statute and had it off to the side. The chart on the right is a graphic from some analysis I did a few years ago for the Permanent Fund Working Group that was chaired by Senator Bishop that shows that had we done that, we would have two funds, and at the time we'd have over $90 billion, probably today closer to $110. So that's what happened with the Permanent Fund until we started doing different things with it. In 2016 and 17 sessions, the dividends were reduced, first by Governor Walker's veto, the second time by budgetary action, leading to 2018 when the legislature passed Senate Bill 26, setting up this percent of market value with the look back. So that's the context on that. What we did before that, before being able to use Permanent Fund earnings as the primary balancer of the budget, was use our constitutional budget reserve. From the moment oil started flowing down taps, there were lawsuits generally tied to royalty valuation, tariffs. Are they paying us the appropriate amount of taxes and royalties? And a lot of major lawsuits were filed and were working their way through the process. As those lawsuits were starting to settle in 1990, the legislature and Senator Hoffman talked about this. He was the chair of the other body's finance committee to help draft this legislation. The Constitutional Budget Reserve was set as a place to hold these funds apart from general government revenue so we didn't spend them as they came in, Article 9, Section 17. Now, in that CBRF section, there are two ways to draw down the money, one by simple majority and the other by supermajority vote. However, the syntax of the simple majority statute uses the term amount available for appropriation. That amount available for appropriation was defined by the Supreme Court to include anything that the legislature can touch by simple majority, including the earnings reserve. So it effectively nullified the possibility of drawing out of the earning out of the CBRF by simple majority, and we've been tied to a three-quarter vote standard since 1994. A total of about $5.5 billion was drawn to balance annual budgets over that 10-year period. Then things turned around. The oil prices got high. We started seeing structural surpluses, and here in the Senate Finance Committee, All of that $5.5 billion was paid back and then some. So the CBR was made whole and then was not touched for several years as we had continuing surpluses leading up to 2014 when oil turned south again and large draws totaling about $11 billion were taken out of the CBRF. Since then, the CBRF held low to $1 billion, $1.5 billion. Every year there was the conversation, are we going to run out? What's the reasonable amount? What do we need to keep for cash flow reserve? That sort of thing. There's been a bit of a turnaround just in the last 2 years. The CBRF now has, we're hearing at the end of this fiscal year, it'll have about $2.4 billion. What happened was, first off, there was the reverse sweep didn't pass, so certain other funds, designated general funds, got swept into the general fund at the end of FY22. And there was also a surplus last year because of the price spike. And although the legislature intended to put a chunk of that surplus into the statutory reserve, that deposit was vetoed by Governor Dunleavy. So the money ended up going into the CBRF. And if you look at the savings chart to the right, the light blue is what I'm talking about, the CBRF. We paid it all back. It grew from $2 billion up to 10 or more by 2013-14 and then shrank back to what we're seeing today. So that's what our savings have looked like in the last 18 years on slide five.
Mr. Albrick, there's no reason to go quite so fast. Make sure we can keep up with our...
You got it, Mr. Chairman. I should pause here. There's a lot going on this slide.
Senator Bishop.
Not a question, just a comment. It's interesting to note that the two co-chairs sitting across from each other in these years of 2012, 13, and 14, the United States was in a recession. The capital budgets that were come out of this table above and beyond the match is what kept Alaska out of the same recession. We escaped that recession, so just a note.
I want to second that comment, and it certainly was the right move at the time. Hopefully we'll continue to use that wisdom in the future. Go ahead, Mr. Hopper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to double down on what Senator Bishop said, Alaska's unemployment rate was running 2 or 3 points below the federal rate during that time period, and that's something we should be proud of, and a lot of that was backed by our ability to have a robust capital budget. Couple of other things as long as we're looking at this chart. The red wedge across the top there, the Public Education Fund, that's what we used to call forward funding of education. During the 2007 through 2014 time period, we were a year ahead on the K-12 budget. We were no longer able to maintain that. So that used to be considered part of our savings balances. So the slide six here looks at what happened in the past since we started using other than the statutory formula. So the POMB draw on the left-hand column, first off, has been growing every year and is continuing to be expected to grow every year going forward. That's something we should be proud of and something we need to cling to as part of our fiscal future. From $2.7 billion in the first year to $3.5 in the coming fiscal year that we're budgeting for to over $4 billion by the end of the current governor's term. The PFD appropriation has been up and down, and you can see that blue column, the PFD percentage of the POMV. The first year we did this, it was 38%. Last year, it was 62% with the large dividends, but we were looking at large amounts of temporary revenue. So, and what the CBR balance was at the end of the year, and this slide's a week or two out of date, that 2253 you see is the end year balance for the CBR plus SBR is going to be a couple hundred million higher than that likely because of some recent upticks in the price of oil. But where the slides diverge below the big red line, what are your options going forward? We have the so-called 50-50 dividend. That's the budget that you're in the process of receiving from the other body. And the 75-25 dividend that's encapsulated in the bill, Senate Bill 107, and what seems to be the committee's policy. So what does that turn into as an approximate PFD amount for the next 5 years? And more importantly, all things being equal with certain budget assumptions, and these are budget assumptions that were used by Mr. Painter last month, $400 million capital budget. It's probably going to be higher than that. There's probably going to be a BSA increase of some sort in that time period. But regardless, what I really want to draw the committee's attention to, Mr. Chairman, are the two numbers circled in red. The difference between them is $4.7 billion. That's really what we're talking about over 5 years between the 50-50 and the 75-25 PFD. Is one way or another, we're going to have to figure out an incremental $4.7 billion to pay for that if there's a desire to fund the dividend at the higher level. And more than any single factor, I think that's what's driving the committee's desire to move the legislation that we're talking about today, Senate Bill 107. I'll take a pause and see if there's anything.
Go ahead.
So, Mr. Chairman, I was asked the question, so what would have happened had the Senate version of Senate Bill 26 passed? This is the original POMV bill from 2018, and we know it as having the 5% look back, the so-called percent of market value, but there were a few other provisions, bills and missiles, appurtenances, what have you, that were in the bill that passed the Senate that did not make it out of the conference committee, did not make it to the final version. Likewise, the House had their own side pieces to it, and all of them were removed in the conference committee. We ended up with a somewhat scaled down bill in the final version. But had the Senate's bill passed, one key piece is, for example, if oil revenue goes above a certain threshold, the POMV would reduce. That was a mechanism that, among other things, would keep from overheating the budget. Another factor there is, and Senator Stedman talks about this, the 5% might be a little too rich for the long term, potentially, as far as keeping a sustainable balance. What starts happening statistically over 20 years, there's going to be a few years with high oil prices, and therefore there would be less than the full 5% POMV, and that made it easier to support the larger POMV in the low revenue years. That volatility measure is what the Walker administration called it, did not survive to the final version of the bill. Likewise, there was language for automatically sweeping ERA balances into the corpus when they exceeded more than 4 years the amount of the POMV. That would have replaced the current inflation proofing language. That did not make it into the final version. And the Senate's version of the bill included an appropriation cap of $4.1 billion. We have to be careful when we talk about appropriation caps because there's a lot of nuance and variable. It depends on how the statute is written. Our 4.1 in the Senate's bill did not include the capital budget, did not include the PFD, did not include debt service, and then it had an inflation adjustment. Some versions of them of these also have population adjustment factors in them. But so what I was asked to do is say, hey, what would have happened? So which gets us to slide 8. So you see part 1. If we had instead gone with the 75-25, which was within the Senate's bill, going back to fiscal year 2019, the last 5 years before the current year we're debating, the CBR by the end of that would have been $4.1 billion. We'd have about another $1.9 billion on the strength of having paid essentially smaller dividends over the last 5 years. And you could see that column called adjustment to savings balance. That's the difference between the PFD that was actually paid out in those years and what would have been paid out under the Senate version of the bill. The second adjustment in the lower left-hand corner of the slide has to do with the oil revenue coming above the $1.2 billion threshold. In retrospect, Mr. Chairman, that might not have been the correct number if 3 out of the last 5 years we've exceeded it, and the 2 previous years we've exceeded it by a bunch. But if that happened, we would have reduced the POMV by that amount. But had the budget stayed the same, we would have needed to find the money from somewhere. The assumption here on this slide is that money would have come out of the constitutional budget reserve. So that now reduces the CBR balance to actually a dangerously low number. We would be at $224 million at the end of the current fiscal year, this coming June. And then there's yet a third adjustment. We would have had to cut the budget because we would have actually been exceeding the appropriation cap that was in the Senate's version of Senate Bill 26 by a total of about $1 billion over the 5 year period, and that would have adjusted us back up to $1.2 billion. Now, all of this, Mr. Chairman, sets aside second order effects. Well, what else could have happened? If all this is in place, likely the legislature would have passed budgets that were different in some way. I can't say to how that would be different. If we start taking less from the POMV because of that oil revenue adjustment factor, the future POMVs themselves start increasing because the end year balance is higher, and then the five-year look-back calculation is higher, and then the next year's POMV gets higher a bit by bit over time, and so on. So there's limits to going down the rabbit hole, but I wanted to put these numbers before the committee so you could see what could have happened had the Senate's version of the bill become law. Which gets us, Mr. Chairman, and here the slide is out of date because this was written last week before the committee took the new committee substitute, which I believe is the R version or the D version. I apologize, not remembering the letter. But the key here is the bill is a 75-25, and then within it is a trigger, a threshold, that says should certain conditions get met, the permanent fund dividend calculation would adjust upward to become a so-called 50-50 split. And as of before the committee substitute passed, it would have been $900 million in new revenue. It has to be recurring revenue the way the bill is written, and this language has survived into the new CS. This isn't about one-time money. This isn't about high oil prices this year. This is quite clearly, and it has to be certified by both the Commissioner of Revenue and the Director of Legislative Finance, new recurring revenue based on legislation that passes compared to how the law read on the first of this year. And there's a sunset. If we don't hit that threshold, well, then the opportunity to go to 50-50 would go away. Now, what happened, and in this final substantive slide, is this is the wrong version of the presentation. I didn't want it to say complicated, but something got lost in the mix. The trigger itself was modified. It should say it's no longer $900 million, it's $1.3 billion. There is also a threshold to say the Constitutional Budget Reserve itself needs to be $3.5 billion or higher, and there's an inflation adjustment factor to that. So in other words, if it gets to 2028, the CBRF, depending on inflation, might need to be, let's call it $4 billion, some number like that. So you could condition this bill to passing some other legislation. There's lots of other things that could potentially be done with a bill like this. Right now, you've got a bill with a trigger, and it's just that the trigger is a little bit higher. But the goal is to put this forward, have a 75-25 that is affordable, that makes for a dividend that we know we can pay for, and then if this or future legislatures choose to raise enough revenue, we would then have the means to afford the larger dividend that many members might prefer. And so that's how we got here, and now it's the decision to say, what are we going to do next? And I'm happy to take any questions.
Mr. Alpert, thank you very much for your presentation. Are there any questions by Mr. Alpert, by members of the committee? If not, our next presentation is going to be by Pete Eklund, which has to do with what the CS does to modify the original bill. Mr. Eklund, please identify yourself for the record. And go ahead with your presentation.
Brief, please.
At ease. Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. Mr. Eklund, please go ahead with your presentation.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Pete Eklund, staff to Senator Stebbins and the committee. Mr. Chairman, a couple days ago, the committee adopted work draft version P of Senate Bill 107, and this presentation will go through and explain some of the rationale for the revenue target that is in the CS of $1.3 billion. So you have, Mr. Chairman, page number one. I pulled these are different graphs that the committee has seen in the past from different presentations. And this was a Legislative Finance table or graph from earlier this session. And what it shows, Mr. Chairman, is this is historical capital budgets. UGF is the blue bars, and the red is bonded for projects. And this is beyond match money, the federal match money for capital budgets. So in the current year budget, the governor has roughly $200 million of match of UGF, and then a $303 million capital budget in total, governor amended capital budget. So this shows that over the years, the nominal average has been over $550 million of non-match UGF and capital budgets. And so right now, just on the governor's amended, he has roughly over $100 million in non-match UGF. And so this is just for historical context, Mr. Chairman. And you can see there, if it was inflation adjusted, the average would be closer to $700 million of non-match UGF for capital budgets. Then, let's see, page two, Mr. Chairman. This is also a recycled slide we've seen before. We wanted to show this. It shows in the yellow there, it shows some of the deferred maintenance needs in the state are $2.2 billion. The state share of school major maintenance and construction is $413 million. The rural sanitation for DEC is $1.8 billion in need. And that's a lot of that would be federal, Mr. Chairman. But this is just going to illustrate that there are a lot of capital needs out there in the state. Go to the next slide, slide three. This was an OMB slide presented earlier this session, and it talks about preventative maintenance and dollars needed to invest in preventative maintenance. And there are different rules of thumb to go by, and the slide just shows that excluding the university, there's over $7.6 billion of the replacement value of state facilities. And if you just used a 1% rule, that would be like $77 million you'd have to invest per year. 2%, $153 million you would invest per year. And this slide excludes the university. They have over $1.5 billion of deferred maintenance identified. And then perhaps, you can't read that very well on the screen the way it's oriented, but this was a slide, and maybe I'll let Senator Bishop talk about it. This was actually a slide that Senator Bishop put together, if you remember, Senator, not to put you on the spot. But you had identified different needs, and go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. everybody at the table knows what's on this slide. We went over it in detail the other day. Nothing's changed, but other than the fact that this gets us in the ballpark, but it doesn't solve the problem. And as the first slide shown, adjusted for inflation, it gets us closer to righting the ship on our deferred maintenance.
It's okay, Don. Let's go to the next slide anyway.
We're good.
And then the committee has seen these slides from Mr. Painter about the modeling assumptions we're going to use when we model different scenarios. And so this is just a standard one because there's going to be a couple modeling slides coming up here in a second. They're based on the spring revenue forecast. That was $73 a barrel of oil. And the spring revenue forecast included Willow and Pica risked. So they're included to some extent in the spring revenue forecast. And then they're using the regular Callan projections for the percent of market value in the permanent fund. And then this is also just a standard slide. And you can see I've handwritten in the capital budget assumption. I use $400 million, but for the amendment or the CS for P for 107, the assumption was $700 million for capital and K-12 increased needs without saying how much would go to capital or how much would go through to K-12, that was built into the assumption that then the CS came out with a $1.3 billion target, and that's how we got to the $1.3 billion revenue target, was moving that capital budget assumption from $400 million to a $700 million assumption for K-12 and capital. So, Mr. Chairman, our slide number 7 is using that. You can see the assumptions in the upper right-hand corner. They're all very similar. We've used them throughout the session, using the Callan assumptions for the permanent fund, using the spring revenue forecast. In this version, it has a House CS of the CS1 of the operating budget. So prior to them getting to the floor, it uses the House version, the investment in the operating budget, at growing at 2.5%. And then for the, it has all the statewide items funded. Then the difference there, you can see the last item, capital and additional K through 12 at $700 million in 24 going forward. And this is a 25% P1V dividend split. And you can see in FY24, the budget roughly balances, but in the out years 25 and beyond, you would need either additional higher prices from oil than the spring forecast to avoid deficits, or you would need some other kind of revenue measures, Mr. Chairman. And of note, you can see on the right-hand side of the chart, that is the savings balances. And you can see that the CBR, because of those deficits after FY25 and beyond, the CBR would be declining down to that, not to go below $500 million needed for cash flow. Slide number 8, Mr. Chairman, is this is modeling the bill version P, and it assumes it shows what would be needed in revenue in FY27 to get to a 50-50 dividend, and that's where you can see in FY27 here you have $1.344 billion. That would be the deficit, assuming these the different assumptions built into the model. Or in the ballpark, and you can see that it's growing in the future. It's over 1.3 billion in FY27, but then it grows up to 1.7 billion by FY32. And so, Mr. Chairman, the CS is based on $1.3 billion coming in FY27, and it's debatable whether or not that's too high or too low. But you can see from the chart that the number is expected. The number of deficit and either revenue, new revenue needed, or I guess cuts to the budget needed, you can see those dollar amounts there, Mr. Chairman. Slide number 9 is also a very common slide we ask legislative finance to do, and this is the probabilistic modeling, and this shows they do a Monte Carlo simulations of many different runs of varying revenues and POMV growth or permanent fund growth. And so, Mr. Chairman, you can see down at the bottom, the very last couple rows, the probability of the CBR below $3.5 billion is pretty high. Even if you raise the $1.3 billion. And so, and again, that is at the spring revenue forecast. If lately revenues have been trending up since the spring revenue forecast. And so, if those trends hold, that would help in the meantime, bolster savings if depending on what the legislature chose to do with any potential revenues.
I think what's really concerning is that bottom line where you go below 500 million in the CBR, the probability of over 50% after fiscal year 29, that's what catches my attention, goes on up to 64% in 32.
Correct, Mr. Chairman. And so.
And this happens even though we're under 75-25?
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, to the chairman, this is at a 50-50 dividend.
Okay, gotcha. You're right.
Even with
the top.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. So under the assumption, so what this slide tells you, if you had a 50-50 POMV dividend, if you met the trigger of $1.3 billion of new revenue in FY27, we'd still have a probability of, you can see the CBR probabilities of under $3.5 billion and under $500 million. So, Mr. Chairman, it just there are risks involved. Almost anything you do, Mr. Chairman. And then we put this last slide in here because people may be thinking, well, we can cut the budget too. It's not just our only option is not just to raise revenue. We can also cut the budget. And this is a slide that it's from Legislative Finance, their data, and it just shows over this particular slide goes back to Governor Walker in the 29th legislature. So you can see from the 29th, 30th, 31st, 32nd, and now 33rd legislature, nominal spending in the, if you look at the far right, this is the operating budget. This is agency operations. If you go to the far right, you can see the nominal column. And if you go down to column 21, over those many years and multiple legislatures and governors, operating budget, UGF, unallocated general funds, has been relatively flat. You've seen some agencies have growth, and those are mainly the public protection agencies, corrections, public safety, and so forth. And other agencies have had decreases. But the overall net effect on agency operations over multiple years is it's relatively flat. And if you adjusted for inflation in the far right column, spending, unrestricted general fund spending is actually down just over 14% over the time period. So that just tells me anyway that many of the large reductions in agency operations have been made, and it's we've had flat budgets overall for many years, and it's difficult to maintain flat budgets forever, Mr. Chairman. So anyway, this is just another point of data for the debate. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Eklund. Do we have any questions by members of the committee for Mr. Eklund? If not, I've got a question back on slide 6.
Sure.
Could you comment on the supplemental budget, which looked like it was $50 million per year? Is that true?
Yes. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 6.
Yes.
The $50 million per year is the assumption for modeling that Legislative Finance uses. That has been the historic average over the last few years of the beyond what is used for LAPs for supplementals. That's been a number of it of UGF ad spend over the years. But as you're aware, Mr. Chairman, this year the supplemental request for fires is more than $50 million, and the total is about $115 million. And so I think Legislative Finance in the future may be revisiting that supplemental assumption. $50 million may be too low.
Okay, that was my real note in that, and it does seem a little low. With that, any other questions for members of the committee for Mr. Eklund? If not, I want to thank you for coming out on short notice, Mr. Eklund, and give us this presentation. This concludes this morning's agenda. Our next meeting will be this afternoon, Tuesday, April 18th at 1:30 p.m. We'll have a second hearing on two bills at least and taking up committee substitutes, Senate Bill 74 by Senator Wilson, Senate Bill 75 by Senator Wilson, which have to do with compacting, or the audiologist and speech therapy interstate compact. After this, we'll intend to continue with public testimony on Senate Bill 52, which deals with the increase in the BSA. There's nothing else to come before the committee. We're adjourned at 10:55.